Hi, everybody. My name's Ari. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ari.
And it is only through the grace of a loving God, strong sponsorship, and unbelievable spiritual experiences through these 12 steps that I have not found it necessary to take a drink since April 9th of the year 2000. And for that, I will never be grateful enough, which means that yesterday I celebrated 16 years of continuous sobriety. For which I take very, very little credit. I mostly showed up and didn't listen to my head that much, and I did stuff that seemed completely wrong in my mind, and I told on myself a lot, and I allowed my higher power to surround me with a network of people who did this work and taught me how to do this work, and I helped other alcoholics as much as I could, and they in turn, just like this book promised, kept me sober even when everything else failed. And I firmly believe that that is why I'm sober today, and I didn't want to let this opportunity of sharing that go by, as today is my last evening here with y'all. So, it's okay, Penny Ann, you'll be fine. So I'd like you to turn to chapter 9, page 122, The Family Afterward, and I'd like to share a little from The Family Afterward, and then we'll go into a vision for you. So this chapter is written to be shared with the family of the alcoholic afterward, but I think there's some things that are very useful for the alcoholic, who is also part of the family. Don't forget that the family is not over there and we're over here. We are returning to our family to be part of our family, not to be elevated on a pedestal, not to be looked down upon, but to be among many. Because I spent a lot of time proving how different I was from my family, and I get special treatment. And when I say special treatment, I mean the psych ward. I get special treatment because I'm the alcoholic. And part of being sober and of being, you know, not full of selfishness, self-centeredness, and fear is being one among many. And that was very difficult for me because I am a very special, special girl. So let's see what they say about this. The secret is the longer I'm very special and different, the more I feel alone, the better chance I have of picking up a drink. So while I don't go and do a fifth step with my family the minute I return from my initial period of possibly separation and sobriety, I also do not separate myself from them, in the way that I'm going to act like I have my life has nothing to do with theirs, which I talked about a little bit last week or the week before. I don't remember. So our women folk, that's very nice, have suggested certain attitudes a wife may take with the husband who is recovering. That was in Two Wives, the previous chapter. Perhaps they created the impression that he is to be wrapped in cotton wool and placed on a pedestal. Not true. Successful readjustment means the opposite. All members of the family should meet upon the common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. This includes the alcoholic. It says all members of the family. Not everyone should surround the alcoholic with tolerance, understanding, and love. It means all members of the family. This involves a process of deflation, meaning what, my ego? The alcoholic, his wife, his children, his in-laws, each one is likely to have fixed ideas about the family's attitude towards himself or herself. Each is interested in having his or her wishes respected. We find the more one member of the family demands that the others concede to him, the more resentful they become. This makes for discord and unhappiness. So you've probably heard, if you've been around at all, that the sickest person in the family is usually the one that is driving the train. That however that person behaves, the one who makes the most noise, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I had a sponsor who in early sobriety told me that I should act like a combination of Cinderella and Mother Teresa and thank my lucky stars that my family was willing to have anything to do with me at all. In other words, I should do chores and be as patient as the day is long because I hadn't done anything to earn my family's good graces. I was receiving a gift. And why? Why do people demand more? Is it not because each wants to play the lead? Is not each trying to arrange the family show to his liking? Is he not consciously trying to see what he can take from the family life rather than give? And where have we heard this before? Anybody? Step three. This is when we're talking about selfishness and self-centeredness and why we're constantly in collision with other people. And the people that we're usually in constant collision with are the ones that are closest to us, our family. Cessation of drinking is but the first step away from a highly strained, abnormal condition. A doctor said to us, years of living with an alcoholic is almost sure to make any wife or child neurotic. Huh. The entire family is, to some extent, ill. And that also goes to explain why people that grew up with parents who are alcoholic often end up with spouses or significant others who are alcoholic. Or people who, it's cyclical. It's alcoholism is a family disease that profligates and perpetuates. I had an alcoholic father, now I have an alcoholic husband. I had an alcoholic mother, now I have an alcoholic wife. It's this thing that if we don't break the cycle of our codependency or our alcoholism, that we keep seeking out the thing that we know. And really, it's not so much about alcoholism as about being caretakers and looking for people who are emotionally unavailable. But this is not a psychology class, so I will just move on. Let families realize as they start their journey that all will not be fair weather. Each in his turn may be footsore and may straggle. There will be alluring shortcuts and bypaths down which they may wander and lose their way. Suppose we tell you some of the obstacles a family will meet. Suppose we suggest how they may be avoided or even converted to good use for others. The family of an alcoholic longs for the return of happiness and security. They remember when father or mother or sister or brother or daughter or son was romantic. Okay, that's kind of weird. Thoughtful and successful. Today's life is measured against that of other years, and when it falls short, the family may be unhappy. So today in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are people, families, never had that happiness. They don't even know what happiness with a particular family member looked like. For somebody like my family, who never had a happy day with me until I had a couple years sober, and I was in my early 30s, because I was a shit show from the time I was 13. The last time I was happy, I was like 10, 9, 8. They don't even know what that picture looks like. They have got no frame of reference. And it's almost safer for my family to have kept me sick. They wanted me to live, but they didn't know who I was going to turn out to be. And that's terrifying. So sometimes, and I mentioned this before when we were talking about working with others, I mentioned something about how sometimes you'll work with people and their relatives or their close family will be a little resentful or a lot of resentful because you're the person that can help them and they couldn't. Sometimes it's because they're losing their true north. They don't know what it's like to do anything besides take care of their loved one. And all of a sudden, I'm a new person. I come back and I'm a new person. And my family's like, well, you've always been this way, and now you're going to be somebody new, and we don't know who we are if you're not the center of the messy universe. Mm-hmm. And I always laugh about it, but my sister is still adjusting 16 years later to me not being the screw-up. Mm-hmm. Poor thing. She just is really having a hard time with it. So I don't want to spend too much time in this chapter because it's a lot of Al-Anon stuff, which I strongly suggest that once you've done this work and gotten through it, that you go and spend some time in Al-Anon and or do that Blueprint for Progress. And, then you'll actually go see the Blueprint for Progress if you haven't, and you'll run screaming like I did the first five times. The thing that I can tell you is that if you're new in sobriety and you think what your family's asking of you is too demanding, shut up and do it anyway. Unless they're asking you to drink, shut up and do it anyway. Because they deserve whatever they're asking. Unless it's endangering your sobriety, you should probably just do it. And because you've already put them through enough if you're sitting here tonight. And if you are sponsoring people who are not willing to show up for their family, then they must not really want to be sober, is what I can tell you. If this, that's a form, a high form of selfishness and self-centeredness to say that, you know, again, unless their family is going to put them in danger of using and drinking. And not just, my mom makes me uncomfortable when she asks me to do the dishes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, real danger. Like, their family's like a crack house kind of thing. I know for me that you can use AA, and especially AA meetings, AA commitments, as a reason not to show up to your for your family. You can use it as a reason to shirk your responsibilities. You can use it as a reason not to go to school, not to go to your job. It talks a little bit later in this chapter about people, a guy at the bottom of 126. Oh, I'm sorry, 125. My pages are stuck together. It says, many alcoholics are enthusiasts. They run to extremes at the beginning of recovery. A man will take as a rule one of two directions. He may either plunge into a frantic attempt to get on his feet in business, or he may be so enthralled by his new life that he talks or thinks of little else. If you've ever met any of those people, I was one of them. In either case, certain family problems will arise. With these, we have had experience galore. My parents' complaint was I was never around for my 3.5-year-old daughter when I was using, and then I was never around when I got sober because I wanted to go to meetings all the time. And my sponsor sat me down and said, you can go to 3 meetings a week. You can go to 5 or 6 on the weekends you don't have your daughter. You have a child. Your job is to be a mother. And I was like, but I have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. She said, that's not in the book. So it's very interesting. If you skip down to the paragraph after, not that we think it dangerous, but it says sometimes mother and children don't think so. Having been neglected, they think father owes them more than they are getting. So sometimes the family wants, you know, financial things to be first of, like, work is more important than anything. And sometimes, like, my family felt that I was shirking my responsibilities. You know, the 1 hour a day, it wasn't really 1 hour because I would go to the meeting before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting. And the thing is, I didn't really want to go to meetings. I wanted to go on dates. Let's be honest. I was going to meet boys at that point in time. And it was working. But balance and being in the right place for the right reason is something that I really had to get across to the people that had to get across to me from my sponsor. And there were many stern conversations. There was a colander of green beans thrown at my head because I infuriated her with my rationalizations. And finally, there was the, if you want what I have, you'll do what I do, and you'll do what I say. And that worked. Mm-hmm. And she was the first person I talked to yesterday, my first sponsor. And she always is on my anniversary. And I'm very grateful that she told me the truth, which was, this is not a selfish program. This is not a me program. This is a we program. But when we talk about we, I'm the last one in line. It's God, AA, me. I don't have to worry about myself if I'm worrying about God and the rest of you. And my family. I don't have to worry about the rest of this stuff. So anyway, that is my experience. I definitely hope that when you do this work, you do read the family afterward with your sponsor. And I sure as hell hope you read it with your sponsees, because it's really important to consider what happens with other people when we're out there. You know, you don't want to be that guy that comes out of the storm cellar and says, gee, mine, it grand, the wind stopped blowing. Because we are the wind. And we're the tornado and the hurricane and the tsunami, and we come out of the basement and we're like, oh, yeah, man, I'm sober now. Things are good. I'm good. I feel good. And my whole life is ahead of me. And your family's like shell-shocked and devastated and wants to trust you and is heartbroken and doesn't know whether or not they should lock away their car keys and their valuables while they take a shower or not. And it doesn't make us feel good to think about it, but, man, that's us. That's the devastation of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. So please take a moment, take a couple moments if you haven't. If you haven't read Family Afterward with your sponsor, ask them. If they say, oh, we don't do those chapters, find someone who does. because it's important to consider ourselves in the position that we play in our family and the people that, that we hurt during our time when we're drinking and using. And it's really important to remember that there's nothing that we do that doesn't affect somebody else. Anytime I think that what I'm doing is only hurting me, I'm full of crap. It's just, that's just selfishness. So with that happy and exciting stuff behind us, I want to flip over to a vision for you. So by the time we get to step 12, which two wives, family afterward, to the employers, those chapters are written for the people they said they're written for. They're written for the wives, the family, and the employers. But the reason they come right after working with others, which is the beginning of step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. So first in step 12, we're going to have having had a spiritual awakening. That's all the steps that come before. Then we're going to practice these principles in all our affairs. Where? At home, with our spouses, with our families, with our jobs. We've got to go out in the world and practice our principles. So what are, last week I said I would email the principles and I never got a chance because this week was insane. However, I pulled them up so I could share them with you. What are the principles of AA? And these are the principles of AA as I make them big enough to see. Here we go. Come on, principles. Man, I am not really having the best technology day. Why is that? Here we go. Okay, the principles AA. So the first principle, the step one principle, is honesty. It is vital to concede that we are alcoholics if we are to achieve sobriety. Yeah, that helps. You have to admit you're an alcoholic. Step two principle, coming to believe, is hope. Coming to believe gives us hope. Because without it, without coming to believe in something that's going to restore us to sanity, it's tough to have hope. Step three is faith. It's that decision to go on with the rest of the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the belief that if we go on with the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we will have an experience that we're promised. The fourth, the principle that corresponds with the fourth step is courage. And it's because it requires courage to do an honest fourth step. You know, my hope for you is that you have as much courage as you need. I seem to get more and more every fourth step I do. Or I just want to be in pain less and less. The fifth principle is integrity, which is what it takes to be as thorough and honest as you need to be to do a fifth step with another human being and God. The sixth is willingness, which is where we ask God, well, we become ready to ask God. So we have to be willing to even be ready to ask God to remove our character defects. And in seven, that's where humility comes. Because in humility, that's the place where, you know, we humbly ask God. We have to be humble enough to ask God to remove our character defects. It doesn't mean we're not human, and it doesn't mean that we're going to not have defects. It means we're going to become aware enough of our defects that we're going to be able to admit they're not working anymore in the way that we need, they used to work for us, and that there is a better way, and that can come. Step eight, becoming willing to make amends, is about brotherly love. It's about taking the walls down and becoming open to not just knowing my part, but admitting it. I don't have to actually do it. I just have to become willing to do it, which I love. There's always the fixin'. I think there was a Southerner involved here. Because like in step six, I'm fixin' to be willing. And in step eight, I'm fixin' to be, you know, ready to make these amends. And in step nine, it's discipline. The hardest thing to do is to go to somebody and that you know isn't going to make amends in the way that you want. Like, it might not want to hear your amends. and make the amends. But it's about becoming accountable. It's about practicing the new behaviors that are replacing the ones that we learned about during our inventory and saying, you know, that behavior doesn't work. I know because it causes these amends. So I'm going to sweep my side of the street clean and now I'm going to practice this new behavior, because making amends means change. It doesn't mean going and saying I'm sorry. It means I'm not only going to make amends by speaking, I'm going to behave differently from here on out. I was told if I'm not ready to behave differently, I should not make the amends yet, which is possibly why I've never made amends to my sister. No, I have made amends to my sister, just not about certain things. Step 10, entering the world of the spirit, that's perseverance. And what we do in persevering is we continue to stay on our side of the street, continue to take inventory, promptly admit it, and it keeps us on the road to happy destiny. It's a diligent process. You know, try, if you get to step 10, if you get through step 9 and then decide, I don't want to live like that anymore, ask anybody who's been there and relapsed, it's a pretty swift descent. To be living at that level spiritually and then slide back down, it's not pretty. I just had a girl ask me to sponsor her yesterday who lived in the work and then just stopped. She just stopped, and she's coming back, and man, they talk about, you know, that misery of having a head full of AA and then picking up again. And I don't think I've ever seen anybody as broken as she is coming back from a relapse, besides the way I was after my relapse, because I was all the way through the work and picked up again because I knew better. Step 11 is spiritual awareness. That's the principle. And, you know, the people that give us as examples in the early chapters of this book are all people who failed to enlarge their spiritual life. I failed to enlarge my spiritual life. This young lady I just spoke of that I met yesterday, she failed to enlarge her spiritual life. Because the thing about spiritual growth is there's no such thing as stagnation in nature. A plant, when you plant it, has, even when it's dormant, cells are reproducing. Like, you're either growing or you're pretty much dying. Like, there's no, like, stasis between progressing towards the next season, or there's no backwards. You're dying or you're progressing towards the next season in nature. And, you know, there's a term they use in medicine called failure to thrive. When alcoholics suffer failure to thrive, we pick up. So, and I fail to thrive when I'm not growing spiritually. And that could mean something as simple as I'm not sharing with the people in my network where I'm at. I'm not continually striving to be truly honest. I'm not continually striving to connect with other human beings and see where they're at. Because when my whole life happens in this area right here between my ears, I will fail to thrive because this is a bad neighborhood. It's always going to be a bad neighborhood, not because I'm not spiritually fit, because this brain is alcoholic. It's an alcoholic mind. I will always have an alcoholic mind. I will always need a spiritual solution. And step 12 is service. We're told that if we have a psychic change, a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we need to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. But there's no past tense. This is all present perfect. You guys know I love language. This is all present perfect. It's all, we're going to be doing this forever. So you don't get to like, oh, I got to step 12 and now I'm done. Wouldn't that be cool? I would be home right now in my pajamas with my puppy. But no, here I am. And, you know, it hasn't been the greatest day. But it's all right. Because I already feel lifted from being here with you. Because the thing is that this working with other alcoholics, this sharing this message, it's not a hardship. It lifts me. And sharing in fellowship with all of us lifts all of us. It's, you know, what are they saying about the minimum wage? A rising tide lifts all boats. The only way that you don't get lifted by a rising tide, by being in fellowship with other alcoholics, is if you don't want to. If you've got cement shoes on and you just don't want to kick up. I used to be one of those people who would go to meetings and want to be miserable. Mm-hmm. I was one of those people who enjoyed my misery thoroughly. Why? Self-pity, for me, was my ticket to the next drink. And then I didn't need a ticket anymore because I just couldn't stop. So I think I have just enough time to get through a vision for you. And I wanted to share those principles with you, even though they are not directly out of the big book. I hope that I don't get, you know, beat up after the recording is heard by the powers that be. I feel like Dave's going to come back and like be like, "What did you do?" Whatever. Sorry, Dave. Chapter 11, A Vision for You. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. For me, it meant loneliness, misery, and dive bars. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. When was that again? Not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There's always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. That would be looking for Mr. Goodbar. Momentarily, for those of you too young to know, Mr. Goodbar, that was a movie about a drunk woman looking to hook up with someone. Momentarily, we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. That still gets me. I wish I had terror. Mostly I had bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I didn't have terror because I always knew. Even when I came out of a blackout, I always knew pretty much what I had done. I mean, the evidence was all there. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. Now and then a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, "I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time." As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take half a dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness, such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. Those are the words that convinced me that I was an alcoholic. I could not imagine my life with or without alcohol. I was so lonely, and I could not imagine living. I couldn't imagine living. I couldn't imagine not drinking. I couldn't imagine to continue my life the way that it was. And I seriously had a very long couple hours. This was about 10 days dry. In May of 1999, so it was before my last relapse, but this was about 10 days dry. It was Memorial Day weekend, and I was sitting on the beach in Spring Lake, New Jersey. And because my sponsor at the time had a house down there, trying to decide whether I should walk into the ocean and not come out. Mind you, I had a child. Or try getting sober. Like, that was the decision. And it wasn't like a small thing. I mean, I spent 4 or 5 hours sitting there. Just not sure what to do. I wished that God would just strike me dead. And for a long time in my early sobriety, at the end of my drinking and in my early sobriety, I used to wake up in the morning and be like, "Oh, really? Why am I still here? Why won't you do this?" I used to pray at night to die. I haven't done that in about 15 years. "We have shown how we got out from under. You say, 'Yes, I'm willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum, like some righteous people I see?' Absolutely not. I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? And have you a sufficient substitute? Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. How is that to come about, you ask? Where am I to find these people? You are going to meet these new friends in your own community. Near you, alcoholics are dying helplessly like people in a sinking ship. And if you think that's not true today, it is. If you live in a large place, there are hundreds, high and low, rich and poor. These are future fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. Among them, you will make lifelong friends. You'll be bound to them with new and wonderful ties, for you will escape disaster together, and you will commence shoulder to shoulder your common journey. And I just want to say a word about sponsorship here. Sponsorship isn't mentioned, really, in the big book, in the sense that, you know, this idea of hierarchical sponsorship where sponsors up here and sponsees down here. When it talks about our fellowship, it talks about commencing shoulder to shoulder on a common journey. The only thing that I can do for a sponsee is share with them my experience, strength, and hope and bring them through this work the first time so they can then bring someone else through it. And sometimes, as it seems, I will be put together with someone who has a life situation that I've already been in, so I can share my experience in that area and say, yeah, I did that. It didn't work out. You might not want to, but if you have to do it that way and learn your own lesson, so be it. My sponsees are not my kids, and they're not my – sometimes they end up being my friends, but sometimes they don't. Depends. But it's not my job to run my sponsee's life. Just because you're new in sobriety doesn't mean you've had a lobotomy. And, you know, I just recently have kind of been blown away by the amount of sponsor worship that I've been seeing in the rooms of AA. And since I have this platform, I just wanted to say that it doesn't have to be that way. You know, your sponsor can just be the person who is your teacher, who teaches you how to use this program to have a relationship with God, who is, and that's who keeps you sober. God, not your sponsor, and teaches you how to teach other people. It's, you know, do in medicine it's see one, do one, teach one. And now it's, you know, in AA it's, you know, do one, teach one, and then you get to see what happens. It's, you know, once you've done it, you can teach it. And that's what I think a sponsor is for. And I would love to see in our fellowship more of a return to that shoulder-to-shoulder versus a hierarchical, like, you know, I have this many years or days, and so you have to listen to me. I know more than you, because that's so sadly not true, unfortunately. And that is my piece on walking shoulder to shoulder, which I have to say is a wonderful way to sponsor, because for me, I get so much more from it that way. Which is not to say that I don't take advantage of my sponsor's wisdom, as she has many more years sober than I do, but we speak to each other. She doesn't speak at me. We speak with each other. And it turns out that, you know, she recently had a situation come up that I went through last year, and then she came to me for help. Which makes you feel worthwhile as a human being, which is pretty freaking awesome. So, we commence shoulder to shoulder your common journey. Then you will know what it means to give of yourself that others may survive and rediscover life. You will learn the full meaning of love thy neighbor as thyself. It may seem incredible that these men are to become happy, respectful, and useful once more. How can they rise out of such misery, bad repute, and hopelessness? The practical answer is that since these things have happened among us, they can happen with you. Should you wish them above all else and be willing to make use of our experience, we are sure they will come. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. Our hope is that when this chip of a book is launched on the world tide of alcoholism, defeated drinkers will seize upon it to follow its suggestions. Many, we are sure, will rise to their feet and march on. They will approach still other sick ones, and fellowships of Alcoholic Anonymous may spring up in each city and hamlet, havens for those who must find a way out. In the chapter, Working with Others, you gathered an idea of how we approached and aid others to health. Suppose now that through you several families have adopted this way of life. You will want to know more of how to proceed from that point. Perhaps the best way of treating you to a glimpse of your future will be to describe the growth of the fellowship among us. Here is a brief account. So here what they're telling us is that they're not saying sit in a meeting and wait for a sick person to come up to you. They're saying if you're in a meeting, first of all, they're not even talking about a meeting. They're saying we're launching the book and go find sick people to help. Now, that's not our reality anymore. But what they're saying is don't wait for a newcomer. You know, the translation, I believe, the extrapolation, if you will, for me, is that, we go to a meeting and there's somebody who's new. They've got 1 day, 3 day, 5 day, 2 weeks, 6 weeks. They're new and they haven't done this work. We don't sit around waiting for them to come to us. They can't get out of their own way. It's up to us to go say, hey, listen, there's a solution, and it is not going to come through this chair by osmosis to your ass. So perhaps, you know, the question I have to ask myself is, am I too busy talking to my friends about the solution we already have to go ask someone who's new if they need help? I know I do that. I get to meetings and I'm tired and it's been a long week and I want to see my girls and, man, I love my home group and I love to see the people I see every week, and then I forget that it's my job to walk up to someone who's got 5 days. I remembered yesterday because I was full of gratitude and it was my anniversary. I don't want to be a jerk, but yeah. So I have to ask myself, am I remembering to fulfill my responsibility? Just a thought. Years ago in 1935, one of our number made a journey to a certain western city. From a business standpoint, his trip came off badly. Had he been successful in his enterprise, he would have been set on his feet financially, which at the time seemed vitally important, but his venture wound up in a lawsuit and bogged down completely. The proceeding was shot through with much hard feeling and controversy. Bitterly discouraged, he found himself in a strange place, discredited and almost broke. Poor Bill. Still physically weak and sober but a few months, he saw that his predicament was dangerous. He wanted so much to talk with someone, but whom? One dismal afternoon, he paced a hotel lobby wondering how his bill was to be paid. At the end of the room stood a glass-covered directory of local churches. Down the lobby, a door opened into an attractive bar. He could see the gay crowd inside, and there he would find companionship and release. Unless he took some drinks, he might have the courage to scrape an acquaintance and would have a lonely weekend. Of course, he couldn't drink, but why not sit hopefully at a table, a bottle of ginger ale before him? After all, had he not been sober 6 months now, perhaps he could handle, say, 3 drinks, no more. Fear gripped him. He was on thin ice again. Again, it was the old insidious insanity, that first drink. With a shiver, he turned away and walked down the lobby to the church directory. Music and gay chatter still floated to him from the bar. But what about his responsibilities? His family and the men who would die because they would not know how to get well. Ah, yes, those other alcoholics. There must be many in this town. He would phone a clergyman. His sanity returned, and he thanked God. Selecting a church, and that's what I call the 3 second delay. Mm-hmm. When you have the thought and then all of a sudden there's another thought and you didn't ask for either of them. Mm-hmm. That's what constant contact with a higher power does for you. It's like you get that quick, like, you know, sober thought that supplants the sick one. It's a beautiful thing. Selecting a church at random from the directory, he stepped into a booth and lifted the receiver. His call to the clergyman led him presently to a certain resident of the town who, though formerly able and respected, was then nearing the nadir of alcoholic despair. It was the usual situation: home in jeopardy, wife ill, children distracted, bills in arrears, and standing damaged. He had a desperate desire to stop, but saw no way out, for he had earnestly tried many avenues of escape. Painfully aware of being somehow abnormal, the man did not fully realize what it meant to be alcoholic. And the asterisk tells us this refers to Bill's first visit with Dr. Bob. These men later became the co-founders of AA, which, of course, we know. When our friend related his experience, the man agreed that no amount of willpower he might muster could stop his drinking for long. A spiritual experience, he conceded, was absolutely necessary, but the price seemed high upon the basis suggested. He didn't want to make amends to all the people he did surgery on when he was drunk. He told how he lived in constant worry about those who might find out about his alcoholism. He had, of course, the familiar alcoholic obsession that few knew of his drinking. Why, he argued, should he lose the remainder of his business only to bring still more suffering to his family by foolishly admitting his plight to people from whom he made his livelihood? He would do anything, he said, but that. Being intrigued, however, he invited our friend to his home. Sometime later, just as he thought he was getting control of his liquor situation, he went on a roaring bender. For him, this was a spree that ended all sprees. He saw that he would have to face his problem squarely that God might give him mastery. One morning he took the bull by the horns and set out to tell those he feared what his trouble had been. He found himself surprisingly well received and learned that many knew of his drinking. Shocker. Stepping into his car, you know, vodka really does smell. Stepping into his car, he made the rounds of people he had hurt. He trembled as he went about, for this might mean ruin, particularly to a person in his line of business. At midnight, he came home exhausted but very happy. He has not had a drink since, and of course, Dr. Bob died sober. As we shall see, he now means a great deal to his community, and the major liabilities of 30 years of hard drinking have been repaired in 4. But life was not easy for the two friends. Plenty of difficulties prevented themselves. Both saw that they must keep spiritually active. One day they called up the head nurse of a local hospital. They explained their need and inquired if she had a first-class alcoholic prospect. She replied, "Yes, we've got a corker. He's just beaten up a couple of nurses. Goes off his head completely when he's drinking, but he's a grand chap when he's sober, though he's been in here 8 times in the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. Understand he was once a well-known lawyer in town, but just now we've got him strapped down tight." Asterisk tells us this refers to Bill and Dr. Bob's first visit to AA number 3. He, in the story section in the book, he's in the Pioneer section, and this was in Akron, Ohio. Here was a prospect all right, but by the description, none too promising. The use of spiritual principles in such cases was not so well understood as it is now, but one of the friends said, "Put him in a private room, we'll be down." 2 days later, a future fellow of Alcoholics Anonymous stared glassily at the strangers beside his bed. "Who are you fellows, and why this private room? I was always in a ward before." Said one of the visitors, "We're giving you a treatment for alcoholism." Hopelessness was written large on the man's face as he replied, "Oh, but that's no use. Nothing would fix me. I'm a goner. The last 3 times I got drunk on the way home from here. I'm afraid to go out the door. I can't understand it." For an hour, the two friends told him about their experiences. Over and over, he would say, "That's me. That's me. I drink like that." The man in the bed was told of the acute poisoning from which he suffered, how it deteriorates the body of an alcoholic and warps his mind. There was not much talk about the mental state preceding the first drink. "Yes, that's me," said the sick man, "the very image. You fellows know your stuff all right, but I don't see what good it'll do. You fellows are somebody I was once, but I'm a nobody now. From what you tell me, I know more than ever I can't stop." At this, both the visitors burst into a laugh. Said the future fellow anonymous, "Damn little to laugh about that I can see." The two friends spoke of their spiritual experience and told him about the course of action they carried it out. He interrupted, "I used to be strong for the church. But that won't fix it. I prayed to God on hangover mornings and swore that I'd never touch another drop. But by 9 o'clock, I'd be boiled as an owl." That's an interesting phrase. "Next day, found the prospect more receptive. He had been thinking it over. Maybe you're right," he said. "God ought to be able to do anything." Then he added, "He sure didn't do much for me when I was trying to fight this booze racket alone." On the third day, the lawyer gave his life to the care and direction of his Creator and said he was perfectly willing to do anything necessary. His wife came, scarcely daring to be hopeful, though she thought she saw something different about her husband already. He had begun to have a spiritual experience. That afternoon, he put on his clothes and walked from the hospital a free man. He entered a political campaign, making speeches, frequenting men's gathering places of all sorts, often staying up all night. He lost the race by only a narrow margin, but he had found God, and finding God had found himself. That was in June 1935, and he never drank again. He, too, has become a respected and useful member of his community. He has helped other men recover and is a power in the church from which he was long absent. So you see, there were 3 alcoholics in that town who now felt they had to give to others what they had found or be sunk. After several failures to found other, a 4th turned up. He came through an acquaintance who had heard the good news. He proved to be a devil-may-care young fellow whose parents could not make out whether he wanted to stop drinking or not. They were deeply religious people, much shocked by their son's refusal to have anything to do with the church. He suffered horribly from his sprees, but it seemed as if nothing could be done for him. He consented, however, to go to the hospital where he occupied the very room recently vacated by the lawyer. He had 3 visitors. After a bit, he said, "The way you fellows put this stuff, spiritual stuff, makes sense. I'm ready to do business. I guess the old folks were right after all." So one more was added to the fellowship. All this time, our friend of the hotel lobby incident remained in that town. He was there 3 months. He now returned home, leaving behind his first acquaintance, the lawyer, and the devil-may-care chap. These men had found something brand new in life. Though they knew they must help other alcoholics if they would remain sober, that motive became secondary. It was transcended by the happiness they found in giving themselves for others. They shared their homes, their slender resources, and gladly devoted their spare hours to fellow sufferers. They were willing by day or night to place a new man in the hospital and visit him afterwards. They grew in numbers. They experienced a few distressing failures, but in those cases they made an effort to bring the man's family into a spiritual way of living, thus relieving much worry and suffering. A year and 6 months later, these three had succeeded with seven more. Seeing much of each other, scarce an evening passed that someone's home did not shelter a little gathering of men and women, happy in their release and constantly thinking how they might present their discovery to some newcomer. In addition to these casual get-togethers, it became customary to set apart one night a week for a meeting to be attended by anyone or everyone interested in a spiritual way of life. So, one night a week for meetings, and anybody could attend. The alcoholic, the alcoholic's wife, the alcoholic's kids, the alcoholic's dog, anyone who is interested. Aside from fellowship and sociability, the prime object was to provide a time and place where new people might bring their problems. And guess what people who had experience did? They brought their solutions. Outsiders became interested. One man and his wife placed their large home at the disposal of this strangely assorted crowd. This couple has since become so fascinated that they have dedicated their home to the work. Many a distracted wife has visited this house to find loving and understanding companionship among women who knew her problem, to hear from the lips of their husbands what had happened to them, to be advised how her own wayward mate might be hospitalized and approached when next he stumbled. And, of course, those kitchen meetings were the beginning of Al-Anon. Many a man, yet dazed from his hospital experience, had stepped over the threshold of that home into freedom. Many an alcoholic who entered there came away with an answer. He succumbed to that gay crowd inside who laughed at their own misfortunes and understood his. Impressed by those who visited him at the hospital, he capitulated entirely when later in an upper room of this house, he heard the story of some man whose experience closely tallied with his own. The expression on the faces of the women, that indefinable something in the eyes of the men, the stimulating and electric atmosphere of the place conspired to let him know that here was haven at last. The very practical approach to his problems, the absence of intolerance of any kind, the informality, the genuine democracy, the uncanny understanding which these people had were irresistible. The absence of intolerance of any kind, so important. He and his wife would leave elated by the thought of what they could now do for some stricken acquaintance in his family. They knew they had a host of new friends. It seemed they had known these strangers always. They had seen miracles and one was to come to them. They had visioned the great reality, their loving and all-powerful creator. Now this house will hardly accommodate its weekly visitors, for they number 60 or 80 as a rule. Alcoholics are being attracted from far and near. From surrounding towns, families drive long distances to be present. A community 30 miles away has 15 fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. Being a large place, we think that someday its fellowship will number many hundreds. This, of course, was written in 1939. But life among Alcoholics Anonymous is more than attending gatherings and visiting hospitals, cleaning up old scrapes, helping to settle family differences, explaining the disinherited son to his irate parents, lending money and securing jobs for each other when justified. These are everyday occurrences. No one is too discredited or is sunk too low to be welcomed cordially if he means business. Social distinctions, petty rivalries, and jealousies, these are laughed out of countenance. Being wrecked in the same vessel, being restored and united under one God with hearts and minds attuned to the welfare of others, the things which matter so much to some people no longer signify much to them. How could they? Under only slightly different conditions, the thing is taking place in many eastern cities. In one of, these, there is a well-known hospital for the treatment of alcoholic and drug addiction. 6 years ago, one of our number was a patient there. Many of us have felt for the first time the presence and power of God within its walls. We are greatly indebted to the doctor in attendance there, for he, although it might prejudice his own work, has told us of his belief in ours. Every few days, this doctor suggests our approach to one of his patients. Understanding our work, he can do this with an eye to selecting those who are willing and able to recover on a spiritual basis. Many of us, former patients, go there to help. Then in this eastern city, there are informal meetings, such as we have described to you, where you may now see scores of members. They are the same fast friendships, There are the same fast friendships. There is the same helpfulness to one another as you find among our Western friends. There is a good bit of travel between East and West, and we foresee a great increase in this helpful interchange. Someday we hope that every alcoholic who journeys will find a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination. To some extent, this is already true. Some of us are salesmen and go about little clusters of twos and threes and fives have sprung up in other communities, though contact with our two larger centers, through contact with our two larger centers. Those of us who travel drop in as often as we can. This practice enables us to lend a hand, at the same time avoiding certain alluring distractions of the road, about which any traveling man can inform you. Written in 1939, in 2014, there are 115,300 groups. There is activity, AA activity, in approximately 170 countries with an estimated membership of over 2 million. Thus we grow, and so can you, though you be but one man with this book in your hand. We believe and hope it contains all you will need to begin. We know what you're thinking. You're saying to yourself, I'm jittering alone. I couldn't do that. But you can. You forget that you have just now tapped a source of power much greater than yourself. To duplicate with such backing what we've accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. So to duplicate what they have made, all you need is willingness, patience, and labor, because with this book, you have tapped into a power greater than yourself. We know of an AA member who was living in a large community. He had lived there but a few weeks when he found that the place probably contained more alcoholics per square mile than any city in the country. Summit? This was only a few days ago at this writing, 1939. The authorities were much concerned. He got in touch with a prominent psychiatrist who had undertaken certain responsibilities for the mental health of the community. The doctor proved to be able and exceedingly anxious to adopt any workable method of handling the situation. So he inquired, what did our friend have on the ball? Our friend proceeded to tell him, and with such good effect the doctor agreed to attest among his patients and certain other alcoholics from a clinic which he attends. Arrangements were also made with the chief psychiatrist of a large public hospital to select still others from the stream of misery which flows through that institution. So our fellow worker will soon have friends galore. Some of them may sink and perhaps never get up, but if our experience is a criterion, more than half of those approached will become fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. When a few men in this city have found themselves and have discovered the joy of helping others to face life again, there will be no stopping until everyone in that town has had his opportunity to recover, if he can and will. Still, you may say, but I will not have the benefit of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that, so you must remember that your real reliance is always upon Him, not upon meetings, not upon sponsors. Your real reliance is upon your higher power. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, or her, or whatever you call God, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact, capital G, capital F. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. And I can't really think of any better way to end this, really. I get goosebumps every time I read this chapter because everything they say is still true. And I couldn't believe when I first read this in 2000, in the year 2000, well, 1999, 2000, that they wrote a book all about me. I wasn't even born yet. I was 60 years from being born in 1939, and they wrote a book for me. And they wrote a book for you. And our job as alcoholics is to share this with people who still suffer. And as usual, in my life, the opportunity to share this, you know, these Sundays with you came at exactly the right time. And I couldn't be more grateful for your time and attention and for the opportunity to be here. So thank you, Westfield Big Book Workshop, and that's it from me.